What's up, listeners? It's Andrea. Today, we give you an impromptu climate change lesson. Beverly's professionalism needs a little brushing up, and we ask the question, how is Parisi Squares played? Let's get our track on.
Welcome to the TNG Podcast, the number one place in the Alpha Quadrant to geek out about all things Star Trek: The Next Generation. I'm your co-host, Charisse.
Hey, I'm your co-host, Andrea. Today, I am super excited to talk about Season 5, Episode 9, A Matter of Time. This episode was written by Rick Berman and directed by Paul Lynch. The crew's attempt to save the inhabitants of Penthara 4 from a devastating after effects of a massive asteroid strike are interrupted by the arrival of Berlinghoff Rasmussen, a purported historian from the 26th century who claims to be studying their era. Super fun episode. What are your initial thoughts on this?
I remembered this one being really fun and having a bit of a twist at the end. So I was really looking forward to watching this episode as an emotional pick-me-up after last week's whatever that was.
Oh, God, yeah. Whatever that was, yeah. Whatever that was is about right. Yeah, I think so, too. It's just this, like, lovely lightness where there's not a lot of risk unless you're the inhabitants of Penthara 4, but we all know that
there's all the risk.
Yeah, then there is all the risk. But we do know, like, it's Star Trek TNG. Everything's going to end up fine, right? But it's just really fun to have this, like, scampy character. Reminds me a lot of, like, the outrageous Okana, but without, you know, the, like, totally
lechery?
Pointless, like, betting of, yeah, of, like, all the women on the ship.
He actually reminded me of Q. That's what I was strongly reminded of. He's such a scamp, and he's so precocious, and he's so just like, hey there. Like, I just thought, I was just like, this is Q. Q without the powers, but with that same kind of effect on people of just kind of being a lot and really having such a big personality.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I think that this was like such a fun role. The actor who plays Berlinghoff Rasmussen, the professor, is Matt Frewer. And he just does the most incredible job as this character. And I keep thinking about how we know the plot twist, you know, because we've seen the episode a bunch of times, but, and I won't reveal until the end for those of you who are watching and listening along, but this man is, we get the vibe right away. He's a con artist. There's something else about him, right? That's like off. So as a con artist, I wouldn't make a good con artist because I'm like brutally honest, right? So that obviously I wouldn't be deceiving anyone. However, if I were, I think I'd be too nervous about it. But he is not. Like, he's walking around and he's measuring paces in Picard's room. And he seems to be so interested in this, like, historical trip that he's taking, you know, where he's like, you're taller in person, or like, you're shorter in person, or this was always, like, this book was always purported to be over here instead of where it is. And that's kind of interesting. Like, he plays it so well that, like, oh, I'm just in awe. Like, Matt Frewer. Snaps to Matt Frewer, because what a killer role. And even though, like, we know the ending, like, he's not going to be around the Enterprise, I wanted to see him again because I'm sure within a couple of years he will have settled into, like, life in the 24th century and gotten used to it and then started another con some way. He would have been onto another scheme.
Yeah, totally. This is a really fun character. Every time I see this actor, but very forcibly in this episode, I think about Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, because that's the first movie I saw him in. He was the neighbor. And so as I'm watching this whole episode, I just kept seeing all the, like, he was the neighbor, and he was like kind of a strict parent. And he was kind of like mean. Yeah. But I mean, that movie is a kid, it's a family movie, and it's very kind of funny and goofy and light. And so he had a little touch of this personality in that movie, but he was also very strict and very serious and wanted his son to be serious and all this stuff. And so for me, it was just really fun to see that guy, like the neighbor, basically being just a total goofball. And you're right. He is like the best con artist in the world. And as I was watching him, I was just like, holy cow, because I knew the twist at the end, but had I not known, I would have believed everything he had to say. And here's what makes his con so perfect. Which we'll get into the episode to, you know, for when he shows up. But what makes his con so perfect is that because he claims to be from the 26th century or whatever, he can't reveal anything to them because of the temporal prime directive. So if they ask him any questions about his background, his credentials, any proof whatsoever that his claims are real, he can be like, time travel. Can't tell you that.
Yeah.
Anything to prove that he's, what happens tomorrow? Anything to prove that what he's saying is real. He cannot reveal it because of the temporal prime directive. I just thought that was the most genius con in the world because it's just foolproof.
Yeah.
You don't have to give any proofs.
Well, and like, of course, people are asking questions. And I think Dr. Crusher's question is like the Tellurian plague. Did they, you know, find a cure? It wouldn't hurt to just tell me yes or no. And I love that he's like, I'd love to, but I can't tell you. And Picard's like, okay, everybody, I know we want to ask these like very innocuous questions, you know, but we can't mess with time. It's the butterfly thing. You know, you step on a butterfly and whatever, right? Like you can't do that. But it is this great foolproof plan. And we'll get into his con a little bit more later, but the episode opens with Panthara 4, killer planet name. Mm-hmm. An asteroid has struck part of the planet, which created these huge dust clouds that block out the sun and basically are creating a new ice age. Mm-hmm. It's essentially a major extinction event, like what happened with the dinosaurs, right? An asteroid, sent out these huge dust plumes and blocked out the sun for like years, to a high enough degree that like things were dying off like crazy.
And it's called an impact winter. When that impact happens and everything gets cold and people start to kind of, they're trying to hunker down before it becomes a full on ice age where everything is frozen and everything is dead.
Oh,
so we've got Panthara 4 that's been hit by this asteroid. So now it will start to experience an impact winter where everything cools down, which is bad news. But Geordi's looking at a way to counteract it. And I thought in this scene, man, I wish we had the technology to alter climate change in a matter of hours or days. It was amazing because I was like, we do have technology to alter climate change. We have all the technology right now to alter climate change, but it's not going to be quick. It's not going to be in hours. It's not going to be in days. It's going to take years and decades. Yeah, decades to actively reverse everything that we've done, which is probably not going to happen. So I was like, dang, if only we had a Geordi in space who could be like, beep, 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 beep. All right, we're just going to come in here and clean up this whole climate change stuff and, you know, make these changes so that way it never happens again. I thought that would be amazing. So Panthara 4 is kind of in a good spot that the Enterprise can come and sort of save the day. Now, while they're heading there to implement Geordi's plan, Worf discovers some kind of temporal distortion that they just passed in space, which is kind of funny because I'm picturing like, you were driving down the street late at night and it's all dark and you thought you saw somebody in the road and you're like, wait, was that somebody walking on the road back there? It's kind of like that. Cause it's like all of space. And you notice some temporal distortion behind them. It's very small. They just passed it. So Picard's like, all right, like let's take an hour since Geordi, you know, it's not going to affect anything either way. Let's take an hour, go back, check out this temporal distortion and just explore because we're explorers. Mm-hmm. And that's when they discover this really cool looking ship, and I don't even know what they think it is. Yeah, pod.
It's called the Time Pod. Yeah, it's so cool, and it's so alien, and it's just so far off of like any kind of technology you normally see. It was like, holy crap, this is so cool. And they get a message from the pod that says, "Move over a little bit." And Picard's like, "The Enterprise is not being moved anywhere until we get some sort of idea of like what's going on here." And Worf is like, "Not the ship, sir. You." And as Picard is like, what the hell is going on? And he moves away from where he was standing. A man like transports onto the bridge right where Picard was standing. And he was like, thank you, Captain. You were just kind of right where I needed to beam on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And his name is Berlinghoff Rasmussen. Best name ever. And
or is it the worst name ever? Who would name their child this? I called
Berlinghoff.
I called him the professor in all of my notes because I was like, this name is too long. It's too much.
The Berlinghoff and the Rasmussen are like pretty badass. Okay. Berlinghoff. Maybe I'll get a kitten and name it Berlinghoff. All right. Anyway. But yeah, the professor. But yeah, I'm getting major con artist vibes and so is everybody else. Turns out he's from the 26th century. He is here to like visit the Enterprise because something big is about to happen and he wants to be there to be a witness to it.
He's a historian.
He's come back 300 some years.
Apparently in the 26th century, this is how people, or I guess it would be called the 25th century, whatever. This is how people explore history is they physically just go back in time and experience it, which actually is a really, really cool idea. And with everything I know about time travel from movies and TVs and books and stuff, also a really, really bad idea.
Yes. Yeah. That might be, you know how last week we were talking about how the Klingons and the Romulans have cloaking technology and the Federation has like sworn not to do that. I feel like when we get to the point in our evolution that we can do time travel, we should probably have some sort of convention against doing it because we know we're going to fuck everything up. Okay. You know how they're like, okay, we're not going to clone humans because you know, like the ethics behind it. It's like, once we're able to time travel, which I don't think that's ever going to happen, but whatever, let's just pretend that we can. I think we should all be like, so we all agree that we have the technology and we're probably, we probably shouldn't be using this. Like we're not capable of controlling ourselves. And we're going to like create an extinction event in like the 1540s. And that's going to be the end of us.
And furthermore, can we focus on what's going on right now? If we can't handle our stuff right now, we don't need the past or the future. Like let's get this together first. It's kind of the same thought when people are like, oh, we want to go out and colonize other planets and stuff. I'm like, well, we kind of screwed up Earth. Can we fix this first before we go to move to Mars? Can we fix, I mean, cool, like having the biodomes on Mars and making new life and all that stuff. The technology needed to sustain life on that inhospitable planet is very cool. And could we also use some of that ingenuity to fix the one we're currently on?
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like I moved into a house and I trashed it and totally destroyed it. And it's just falling apart and the beams are falling off and it's all rotted wood. And I'm like, oh, well, guess I finished with this one. Let me move to the house next door. Yeah. But like, maybe not yet. Till you learn.
What's your plan to like not have that happen again?
Yeah, but don't put me in charge of any of these decisions.
Clearly. Yeah, nope. So anyway, the professor is bouncing around and he's like, I'm going to come up with some questionnaires for you all to answer. And Worf couldn't be more thrilled about that.
He's meeting in the observation lounge with all the senior staff and they've got a million questions, none of which he can answer because of the temporal prime directive. So they're kind of like, how do we know this is true or not true? And he's like, well, I can't answer that. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting scene because I don't know if you had something to say about while he's there, but after he leaves, my whole thought was, why doesn't Troy just read him? Like, is he being honest or not? And then as soon as he leaves, they turn around to Troy and they're like, Troy, what do you think? And Troy's just like, he's holding something back, but I can't tell what it is. I don't know what he's holding back.
This is, again, where Troy is not very useful.
Not super helpful.
We all know that this dude is not to be trusted. Like his con vibes are like, he's giving major con vibes.
Yeah.
Okay. So like, we already know there's something about him that can't be trusted. I don't need you to tell me, Troy, that there's something about him that can't be trusted. I already know that.
And then Beverly chimes in and says, well, of course he's holding something back. He's from the future and there's all this stuff he can't tell us. And again, I thought, dang, this is a good con. You can even pull a Beta Zed, but I mean, I guess
it is
half.
Like airtight. It's airtight. Yeah. And he does this thing as he's talking to Picard in his ready room and then in the observation lounge where he's like, huh, historians always thought that this book was always on this table. Or like, Mr. Worf, do you always sit in that chair? Right. And it's just enough to wrong foot everybody to be like, oh, I mean, normally I do. Wait, why would you know where I would sit? Like, that's not important. Right. And Picard even says, like, you can't honestly tell me that the position of like my book is going to matter in 300 years from now. Mm-hmm. And the professor is like, every historian alive in the 26th century knows the layout of the Enterprise D's like bridge and ready room and everything. Like, it's historical. And it's like, okay, this is, are you sure? Right. But of course it's that airtight alibi where it's like, well, I can't tell you when you're like, dang it. Mm-hmm. and Data escorts the professor to his quarters and he's extremely rude and dismissive of Data. Like he does this thing where he, and this always weirds me out on the Enterprise where they pull back the shelf and it's got like a little sink of water in there, which in my mind, I'm like, ew, the mildew. Right. But like it's the Enterprise. So I'm sure that water's reclaimed. It's
filtered,
fine.
It's good.
It's whatever. Fine. Yeah. But he washes his hands and then he holds his hands out like a little king and Data has to put a towel over his hands. And that towel, by the way, did you notice the material was so cool? It was like holographic-y kind of like towel. And I just thought that actor is just smearing water around his hands as he dries.
Yeah.
But it looks cool for the show.
I think they used that towel last week too, because somebody spilled something or whatever. And they used that as well.
Oh, really?
And yeah. It was either last week's episode or the week before. But I remember being like, oh, it's that towel again. Cause the first time I saw it, I remember thinking exactly as you said, like, this is like a silk, like shiny polyester towel. This is not absorbing anything.
No, it's just smearing water around.
What kind of fabric are you guys thinking on this Enterprise? Like y'all, no, this is not absorbent. And I also thought, why do you even have towels? you guys don't have air dryers. You know how we have that? We have that technology now where you can
now.
Just, yeah.
Yeah.
So I was like, that's interesting. Cause I don't know when those things were invented. And I
don't. Cause then you just need like some pressurized air, which you have a lot of on the Enterprise and you don't need to carry towels, but whatever. Okay. Who knows? Who knows? But
it was a future towel. That was a nice touch.
It was a future towel. That was cool. Data wants to ask him like, do you know if I'm still in air quotes, like alive in the 26th century since, you know, I'm a machine. And he's like, you know, it's best you just don't even like ask me questions like that. But he's so rude to Data. I was like, dang. And I heard this saying a long time ago, and I think it's extremely true. If you want to know what kind of person somebody is, look at how they treat those below them, like the help or the servant or the whatever, you know, whoever, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you see,
or like somebody who
exactly
is cutting the grass or somebody who is painting the house or
exactly
coming to help, like helpers.
Yes.
Like how do they treat helpers? Do they treat them as servants? Like trash on your shoe. So beneath me, or do they, you know, the maid at a hotel, like
exactly,
or do they treat them as human beings, which is what they are doing a service and that you don't want to do.
Exactly. And when I say people who are below you, I don't mean it
like
at all
status,
like that way, but yes, in status. Exactly. But yeah. And I thought that was, I think it's really a spot on observation because I have seen people that I've known and it's like, let's go get a manicure or whatever. And we all go do like a manicure and they treat the manicurist like trash. And it's like, what is wrong with you? Mm-hmm. Or people who, you know, dating advice 101, if somebody treats like the wait staff at the restaurant that you're at the state at like trash, that's a clear sign you need to.
Yeah. That means that person is trash.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
person is trash. That's yeah. why they're
treating no, it's
else
awful.
Badly.
Mm-hmm. It's awful. But the way that he treats Data when they're alone, so nobody else is there to see how he behaves towards Data, I was like, you're trash. You are trash.
Because when he was in front of everybody, he's all smiles and everything else.
Yes. So we cut quickly to Penthara 4, this like scene above the city. And I don't know about you, but I love my Christmas traditions. And me and my family watch that claymation Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer movie every Christmas. And that blizzard on Penthara 4 looked like the blizzard like at the North Pole. It was just like so cartoonish. I was like, this looks like the blizzard from Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, which I think came out in like 1963 or something.
Something like that. Yeah.
It was so bad.
I don't really remember that scene, but I do remember thinking to myself, once the sun is blocked out, how long does it take for things to cool down? Like how many days or weeks to go from it's cold to it's freezing?
Yeah.
So I did have that thought. So I don't know what the weather changes would be like immediately, because like the sun doesn't just affect the physical weather, like the temperature of the air. It also affects air currents. It also affects water currents. Mm-hmm. So if we don't have water swirling around, if we don't have air swirling around, that does affect everything, or if it's not swirling around the way it normally does because of the heating of the sun. So I was thinking like, how quickly would we see climate change if the sun was blocked out?
No, I think it would take a while. I read a really fantastic book called Field Notes from a Catastrophe. It's a really great book about global climate change and stuff like that. And it breaks it down into very manageable bite-sized pieces. And I was not majoring in marine biology yet when I read that book. So I had like, you know, a passing understanding of like, you know, global science type stuff, but I really wasn't into like the nitty-gritty details yet. And I was able to like read it just fine. It's a really fantastic book. And it does talk about how the planet is like a pot of water, like a big pot of water that's like boiling over, right? Like once you kill the flame underneath that pot, it's going to take, you know, an hour before that water is cool enough that you can like stick your hand in it, right? So you've got this latent heat that like continues, and water holds such heat. Water has a very high heat capacity. Its ability to take in heat before it goes up by 1 degree Celsius in temperature. So you and I live in Los Angeles. I live by the beach and I go surfing because it's the summertime now, and I go surfing most mornings. And on days where it's blazing hot out, you're like, ooh, the ocean's going to feel so good. And you go into the water and you're like, why is it still so cold? Because it takes so much heat to warm up 1 gram of water, 1 degree Celsius. That's, that's like the heat capacity of water. Right. And so on a blue planet such as ours, that's mostly water, most of our latent heat is stored in the ocean. Right. So like you have to let that pot of boiling water like cool down for a long time. But Penthara 4, I don't know what their water, you know, like how much water they have. So it's if it's mostly land, that he will dissipate extremely quickly. That's like if you're out in the desert when it's really hot at noon, and then at midnight, it's freezing cold as soon as the sun goes down. Right. Yep. So if Pandora 4 was more of like a land planet, then that global ice age would happen very quickly. If it was a water planet, like ours is like 70 something percent water, it would take
a little more time.
It would take months and months and months. Yeah, it would take months.
In any case, these people are in trouble because you need the sun.
Big time.
You need the sun, and all these dust plumes are blocking it. So they have this plan to drill a bunch of holes in through the mantle of the planet. That's going to release some of those pockets of heat from the volcanoes underground. And that's going to basically create a greenhouse effect that traps all the heat in the planet.
And it's a brilliant plan.
It's so
like you've got these CO2 pockets. Like let's pop those open and let the CO2 escape. I feel like they have as well.
We've talked
right?
about it before. Yeah, they did that before. I think on that planet with like the fish faced people.
Yes, you're right. They were like, again, having some like a impact
something,
event sort of,
something
or something,
happened,
some global
they had to release the pressure.
Crisis.
I think for that planet, they had a bunch of earthquakes or something. And so they had to release pressure
from
underground
to
stop the earth from shifting. But in this
case, that feels really season one, season two.
I believe it was season one, maybe it was season two, but yeah. So they're trying to trap all the heat. And this was so interesting to me because I thought, because the scientist says, he says, we've tried so hard to prevent global warming on this planet.
Yeah.
And now we're doing the exact opposite to save lives. And it's so counterintuitive. And I just thought to myself, it's so much easier to create the greenhouse effect than it is to reverse the greenhouse effect.
Yes.
It's like a few calculations, and we can put all the heat into the air. But to like do the opposite, if the planet is all overheated or whatever, to kind of fix it or cool it down or take the pollution out of the air or whatever is very hard. And I thought this is very similar to like gaining weight. To me, it's super easy to gain weight.
Yes.
And it's a lot harder to lose it.
Yes, like, totally.
Yeah. Or staying up late for me. It's really easy for me to stay up late, but it's really hard for me to wake up early. Like it's just easier.
Yeah.
It's like so disproportionately easier to do the thing that can be more harmful sometimes. So anyways, I'm like really hoping as this episode's going on, I'm really hoping that this works and that the planet is saved and that it's pretty nice and easy. And honestly, after they shoot the little vents in, everything seems like it's going well. And you're like, cool. They solved that. So now back to this time traveling scamp. And then it's like, uh-oh, there's trouble. And I was like, oh, snap. I didn't see that coming.
We start to see this like cascade failure. And you're like, oh, God. Right. And things, and it's a very, very rapid domino effect. Mm-hmm. Like just this absolute cascade of one catastrophe after the other. And now they're starting to get these like major earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, which are putting more dust in the air, like ash and dust in the air, which
blocking
is blocking
out
the sun
faster.
Even more, right? Because they said 20% of the normal amount of sunlight was getting onto the surface of the planet. So they're at 80% darkness. Now it's going to be like 90% or more, right? And Riker is like, look, and they do this really cool little schematic thing, which is just for the audience, but they line up the sites that are having the volcanic eruptions and they line it up with the sites that they did the drilling and they line up, they like overlap perfectly. And Riker and Picard were like, we came here to help and look at what we've done. And it was like, oh God. And I do love when like something that they try seems to go well and then suddenly it doesn't because it's way more real life. And they're like, I don't know, we'll try this thing. Pew, pew, pew. Okay. Everything's solved. Off we go. It's like, no, that's not how it really goes.
So I'm so tempted to just finish up this plot because it's so interesting, but it is very much involved with what the professor is doing.
Yes.
Because this planet is in danger and the professor knows the future and could help them, but can't because the temporal prime directive. So, oh, it's so painful. Okay.
Well, here's the thing that really kills me in this moment in the episode. You know, the Enterprise is like, Dr. Whoever down on Pandora 4, we're going to get back to you. We're going to start, you know, trying to look at some solutions.
Make some other plans. Yeah.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Rasmussen is starting to rub everybody the wrong way. The next thing we see is Troy and Beverly are in sick bay and she's treating, a crewman who's got a bad gash all over his leg and he's bleeding all over the place. And Troy is like, I don't know, Beverly, there's just something about him that rubs me the wrong way. Like he's hiding something and whatever. And Beverly's like, well, I filled out the questionnaire and like, everything seems on the up and up to me. I don't know. if I were that patient, I'd be so freaking irritated that I'm bleeding all over this table with Beverly, who's just like gossiping about this professor that I don't know nor care about. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's like, can somebody treat the like contusions on my body in a professional way?
Because you guys are not.
Yeah, where's Alyssa? Maybe she's still detoxing from the game. I don't know. But but I was like, do you mind? Like, that guy had the coolest like blood makeup on his leg. Like,
it was very
he clearly
cool.
took
it
a
legit.
Bad like fall or attack by something on the holodeck and got all
a vicious
messed up.
Game of Parisi squares, probably.
Yeah. Every time. That's why you don't allow your kids to play Parisi squares.
That's exactly
it's vicious.
Why.
Mm-hmm. I love that it's a game that we know nothing about, but we do know it's crazy dangerous.
That's all we need to know.
We don't know the rules. Is there a ball or a hoop, or do you have to jump over a thing? Are there swords, lasers, phasers, animals? What do you do?
We don't know. Some nerd out there has got to have invented this game.
It seems by the uniforms, it just seems like really aggressive dodgeball. But man, people are getting really fucked up, like Parisi squares. Really. Anyway, this guy took some bad falls and got blood everywhere, and he's just trying to get himself healed up so he can get back to work. And here's Troy and Beverly just gossiping about this dude as they're hovering over this guy with the fucked up leg. And it's like, wait, what? This is like the most unprofessional setting I've ever seen in my life. But anyway, in the midst of all this, the professor comes breezing in and he's asking about the questionnaire. And I love that Troy is kind of not beating around the bush. She's like, I don't know if I trust you. And he's like, ah, come on, I'm a good guy. And she's like, you're right. I don't trust you at all. And like kind of huffs off and she leaves and he is all over Beverly, who is just red as a beet, just blushing mm-hmm. all over this man. And I was like, Beverly, you just have not awesome taste in men. I'm not going to lie.
But she does, though. Her last two love interests were wonderful people. She's just being taken in by this guy who's extremely charming. He's making his intentions very clear. He's like, he's not beating around the bush. He's like, this, I want to explore something with you or whatever.
Yeah.
And so she's like, what about time? What about that? And he's just like, well, I mean, who cares about that? You know, suddenly he could care less about the temporal prime directive. So they're kind of flirting. And then she's like, no, I don't think this is a good idea. So he leaves, but he leaves with her like laser scalpel or whatever, because he had asked, or some neural scanner, because he had asked earlier.
Yeah.
And again, I just thought like, dang, that was smooth. Like he took it in front of her face, held it up and showed it to her as he walked out the door. And she's just mm-hmm. like, bye. Because this is like a magician, right? Mm-hmm. This is the art of misdirection. She's so flustered by the little flirtation that just happened. She's not even tripping off of the device that he just walked out with. Whatever. Like he'll bring it back.
Well, he did go in and ask for it. That was the reason
he came.
He was like, hey, you talked about this neural scanner.
But
I'd really love to see it.
He needs to like leave with it, right?
Yeah. 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 Where he's like, do you mind if I take one and take a look at it? And she's like, okay. And you're right. Con man or con woman or con artist is short for confidence. You gain people's confidence. And then that's when you pull the rug out from under mm-hmm. them. So he is working his charm. And even though we know that there's something really conny about him, we really don't know what it is yet because the other shoe hasn't dropped. So we just know that there's something shady about this dude and he is really pulling out all the tricks. Yeah.
Yeah. And we skipped this part, but earlier in engineering, he was talking to Geordi and Data as they're working furiously trying to save Pinthara 4. And when they're not looking, he slips one of the data pads into his pocket.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And again, it was like this art of misdirection. He's kind of irritating them to the point that they don't want to look at him. And when they turn away, he like sneaks away. He was telling Geordi about all the famous blind people he knows of. And Geordi's just like, I'm busy here. And he's like, well, there's Helen Keller. And they're like, whatever. He's just saying all these like blind people. And like, what does that have to do with Geordi and what he's doing
Geordi
right now?
Geordi is like, I don't identify solely as a blind person. So this isn't really like a thing that I would go for. Where it's like, oh, you like Parisi squares? Let me tell you about all the famous Parisi squares people I know. Cool. Okay, that might be interesting. But Geordi's like, being blind is like tertiary to like my personality or anything. Like it's not even an issue. Like it's not even tertiary. That's giving it way too much credence. Mm-hmm. Like it's like nothing, right? He does ask him a bunch about the visor. So it's like, okay, there's clearly some interest. Now, the professor visits Data to thank him for turning in this questionnaire that he wrote like 50,000 words on. And Data's listening to like four symphonies at once. So he kind of, weeds them out. And that's kind of cool to see.
Yeah.
And again, as he started chatting with Data, and Data is kind of like busy doing work, Rasmussen again steals another piece of technology. And I wrote, why would you steal something from Data? Like, he observes everything all at once. Mm-hmm. He's a machine. There is no misdirection. Huh? Like, that didn't make it. I was like, I'm going to say false on that.
Yeah. Some of these things, it's like, okay, the thing from Beverly, he said, can I see it? So she's just like, oh, he's leaving with it, but whatever, he'll return it. The thing from engineering, there's a lot of people in engineering. That data pad could have just been moved to another station. Like, so totally reasonable. But to take something from someone's quarters and that someone is Data.
Yeah. Who would immediately know it's missing?
Yeah. That's not going to go unnoticed. He will immediately know that it's missing. So that didn't make a whole lot of sense, but he's just doing his thing. You know, he doesn't know, he has never met Android before. So that's what he does. He snatches something else. I think that one was a tricorder.
Yeah. I think he did take a tricorder, 'cause he like opened it up and he was like, right. Oh, another little piece of technology that we see on the professor. And I really, really enjoy is, he has this little like watch, but it's a ring. He like opens it up and they do a little zoom in on it. And it is so 1991 technology. It's got like a little tiny panel and like two little buttons, you know,
it's like a little Game Boy controller.
Yeah, it totally is. It totally is.
You, and youngsters it's can Google really Game Boy controller to get a picture of what that device looked like. Actually, you just watched this episode. It's the ring.
Yeah. It's the same thing. It's bitter. You don't need to Google anything. It's fine. And like, you know, Data sees Picard at this point with an idea. He's like, you know what? We may just be able to use the Enterprise as sort of a lightning rod to suck out the excess heat and then turn around and then kind of blast it harmlessly out into space. The problem is, and this feels like a CRISPR issue, you know, the technology CRISPR. Mm-hmm. If you get it a little bit wrong, everybody dies. Yeah. And it's like, oh.
The only downside. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, yeah. So he's like, there's just one little downside. If we get this just a little bit wrong and the margin of error is like razor thin, we'll end up burning up the entire atmosphere of the planet. So then no life can be sustained.
Okay. So this is mind blowing. This part, I was like, oh, like as far as technology goes, this is the kind of sci-fi stuff that I really love when they sprinkle it into the episodes.
Yes.
So there's all this dust in the atmosphere now that's blocking out the sun. So Data comes up with this plan to convert all the dust into plasma, boiling hot plasma, like electrically charged plasma. But it will no longer be dust. So that's a good thing. But it will be deadly plasma, which is a bad thing. But they can soak up all that plasma into the Enterprise and then just shoot it off into space, which again, I'm like, shoot it off into space. Like there's no air resistance in space. So that plasma is going to hit something at some point.
That's what I thought. At some point it's going to hit a planet
or a ship or whatever. But let's say instead of they just shoot it off into space, let's say it just dissipates. We'll change the idea of how this works.
Well, you know what I did notice is that when they did this, they kind of shot the beam in like a big arc. So even if there's this like bit of plasma that hits, it's not going to hit a whole area
with the planet shooting it like plasma.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That was my only.
Yeah. I was kind of like, it's kind of like when people shoot guns in the desert or whatever, and they just like fire a bullet up.
But yeah. Where
like
do you think that shit goes?
Down. Yeah. And you're like, let's not just like shoot bullets. Well, anyways, so that was the idea, which is genius. But yeah, like you said, if it doesn't work, the whole atmosphere burns off, which exposes the entire planet to the vacuum of space, killing every living thing on it. And I thought, wow, the stakes could not be higher. This is terrifying.
Yeah.
And when Picard was like, I have to make this big decision, I immediately thought, well, wait a minute. This isn't your decision to make. This is the planet's decision to make.
Yes.
Because they're the ones who will instantly die if this doesn't work. And I don't know what call they're going to make. Thankfully, later on the episode, they mention that they talked to all the planet's leaders.
Yes.
They all got together and talked about it and decided, you know, whether or not they were going to go with Picard's plan.
I thought of that too. You know, I didn't actually originally think like, hey, Picard, this is not your call to make in the first place, because it is his ship and all that stuff. And they are there to help, but you're absolutely right. It's not your call to make.
It's not your call to make. They're there to help. But if you burn off the whole atmosphere, we all die.
Exactly. If you're there to help and we accept the risk, then cool, let's go ahead with that. Mm-hmm. But if we don't, then like, you're not doing anything. Leave us alone. Now,
evacuate us or something.
Picard is like, okay, I've got this huge conundrum on my plate. If we do nothing, this nuclear winter will continue and thousands and hundreds of thousands of people will die. Okay. Eventually, because of starvation and all that, the cold and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. if we try this plan and it goes badly, every living thing on the planet will die. So it'll be like hundreds of millions of living things will die instead of hundreds of thousands. So do something and everybody could die. Do nothing and lots of people will die. So this is where he decides to break the temporal prime directive. And I love that he asks Rasmussen to meet him in his ready room and they kind of end up having this chat. And he says, you know, the prime directive, of course, which I'm sure you're aware of, exists so that we don't interfere with other cultures, blah, blah, blah. And I love that Picard says this. He's like, on multiple occasions, I have disregarded the prime directive because I thought it was the right thing to do at that time. So I need you to kind of tell me what's going to happen with whatever choice I make. Like, what does history say about this? And Rasmussen's been running around acting like everything that's happening on this mission is so important that they're like, oh, so you're here to witness this mission. Like something big happened. Mm-hmm. And like, you have come back 300 years to witness what happens here. So clearly something really big happened. I need you to tell me what that is. And of course, Rasmussen, you know, waffles around. He's like, I can't do that. That's, I can't.
Yeah. And
I can't.
He gives the whole explanation of the butterfly effect. And he's like, but if one butterfly flaps his wings, whatever, he starts to give the whole thing and Picard stops him right there. And he's like, yeah, I took philosophy in the academy or whatever also.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And what I love is Picard, this is when we get huffy Picard. He's starting to get irritated because he's like, I need answers and I need to save lives. And he goes, this is not hypothetical. This is not theoretical. This is real. These are real people's lives. So all that butterfly effect stuff goes out the window. We were talking about 20 million humans and countless plants and animals and bacteria and fungi and fish and birds.
An entire planet.
As well. So he's like, this is not theoretical. You have to do the right thing. And the professor's just like, I just can't. I can't. Which again is, it's
airtight. Brilliant.
It's airtight. It's airtight.
Well, and the other thing I like that he says is, everybody dies, Captain. Like every single thing on that planet has been dead for hundreds of years before I was even born. Everybody dies. And it's just a matter of like when. And we think that that is so important, you know, where and when I die is so important. But when you read a story about, you know, let's say you're reading a story about a historical figure and you're like, did they die in the 1450s or the 1480s? I don't remember. Who cares? It doesn't matter. It's like, well, to that person, it really matters. Mm-hmm. Right. But they've been dead so long. It's like, who cares? A couple dozen years, fine, whatever. Like what we know for sure is that person who was alive in the 1450s sure as hell isn't alive now. So it's like, it doesn't matter. And I could see that perspective. If I think back to 300 years ago, who cares if this guy died this year or 5 years later? It doesn't matter, except it matters extremely in that moment to that person to that and their person. Family and their friends and all that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It really matters.
He made this really good point where he said, all of this is in my past. This is, this has already happened. This is already done. So this has nothing to do with me in the present, which is very cold, but also very true, which is, again, one of the problems with time travel is that perspective is not, you don't have the same stakes, which is why you're not afraid to mess stuff up, which is why you probably shouldn't do it. But then Picard counters with, well, you know what? Everything in your past is my future and it is unwritten for me. So I can change it willy-nilly. You're saying like, you can't do anything because you don't want to change your life.
The timeline. Yeah.
You don't change the timeline because it might affect you. Well, if you don't care about the past, I don't care about the future, right? I'm going to do what's right now. And it doesn't matter what happens to your past, to your timeline. And I thought that's a good point too, because everybody's looking at it from their own point of view. And they both have really good points. And it was very hard to watch the professor be so flippant about this whole planet potentially dying. I mean, granted, we know something's suspicious. And so he's not going to give up any details. However, it was just like, how can you really be that cold? How can you really even pretend to be that cold? I mean, he could have been like, I know this is really hard. It's so hard for me to not say anything. You know what I mean? Like he could have played it up to like, I'm really emotional about this decision, but I know the right thing for me is not telling you what's going to happen. He could have done that, but he didn't. He was just like, who cares? Whatever. They've been dead for hundreds of years. I don't care. Moving
doesn't
on.
Matter.
Let me get some tea. So did you finish my questionnaire?
Just feeling.
No feelings.
Well, that's when everybody's like, okay, I think we've all about had it with Berlinghoff, exactly right. Rasmussen. Mm-hmm. Like we're all pretty done. Now, Picard does say, listen, because you didn't give me the answers, you actually reminded me of the importance of the right to choose. And it's your past, but it's my present and future. So I can choose what I want to do with it. And he's like, I've never been one to like play it safe, which I'm like, yeah, you have a bunch of times, but okay, whatever. Especially when you're dealing with the lives of like millions of people, you probably want to play it safer, but all right. But he does choose, because it's Star Trek, to try Data's firing sequence. And for a minute, it looks like everything went to hell, because now all that dust is converted to plasma, which is all burning in the atmosphere. And it looks like a fiery pit. And you're like, oh my God. But then at the last minute, it's sort of like whoop, all goes to the Enterprise, and the Enterprise shoots it off into space. And we're going to say it dissipates, because otherwise we've just like taken out an entire star system.
Exactly. With hot, burning hot plasma while they were just taking out the, doing the dishes, taking out the trash.
Yeah. And like, kabam, they're done. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now Rasmussen is clearly nervous about the ship, because as it's absorbing all this plasma, it's like rocking around and like, and he's looking pretty nervous now. And so that is like the final topper on the cake, where it's like, yeah, okay. If you knew what happened and everything turned out fine, you wouldn't be nervous at all. So clearly something is extremely wrong here. And it works. And Penthara 4 is now saved. And yay, thank you, Picard. And ta-da. And everybody's and like, Geordi, you stays, a debt of gratitude.
Geordi stays on the planet to help them with the after effects of this plasma thing. And before they do this procedure, Picard's like, hey, Geordi, time to come back onto the ship because we're about to blast the planet. And Geordi's like, no, they might need me after the blast. There might be some fallout or something. And they'll need like someone who's really quick to make repairs. And Data's just like, yeah, the computer can do it, but Geordi can do it faster because he has that human intuition of knowing what needs to be done and the priorities and stuff. And Picard's like, Geordi, you realize we have no guarantee that this is actually going to work. And Geordi responds with, yeah, but Captain, you realize that we have no guarantee it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. And I just love that, because in my life, so much, especially nowadays, so much is like, it's not going to work. There's no guarantee it's going to work. There's no guarantee it's going to work. So it's so good for me to hear, just be reminded, like, there's no guarantee it won't work. Like it could work also, but that's also, it could also work. Yeah. So I really appreciated that. And it was a very scary situation, not just for the whole planet, but they could have also lost Geordi, but all is well. Everything's good. And Rasmussen jumps up and he's like, see, everything went well and you didn't need any help from me. Wasn't it so good that I didn't interfere? All righty then, time for me to be out. Beep, 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 do. And he like kind of stumps off the bridge, kind of looking around, like so interested in the bulkheads and whatever. And you just look at the look on Picard's face. He is so disgusted with him. He has nothing to do with it. He turns to look at Riker. They both do like a stank face. And then he turns to look at Worf and nods. Right as the turbo lift doors close on Rasmussen, and you're like,
they do the look. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And immediately, you know, they've got a plan.
Yep.
And
they didn't profess any of this.
Not any of it. Now, Rasmussen shows up to leave in the cargo bay where his time pod is at, and the senior staff is there to greet him. And he's like, would you look at this? Like a goodbye party. This is so nice. And they're like, oh, I wish that's what was going on. A number of objects have been reported missing, and we think that they might be in your ship. And our scanners can't penetrate the holes, so we're going to need you to just go on in and open it up for us. And he's like, oh, we've already been through this, Picard. You're trying to take a peek at like 26th century technology. You scamp, can't let you do that. And he's like, no, we're getting into this thing. So Rasmussen is like, okay, how about,
oh yeah, considering Worf says, if you don't open the door, I'll open it for you with explosives.
Yeah. And he's like,
well, on second thought.
Yeah. On second thought, what if we just have Data come in with me? Because if you order him never to divulge like what he's seen, you guys will be like safe from this like temporal, you know, like prime directive.
Whatever, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so Data's like, okay, fine. So Rasmussen does this little handprint scan on the back of the ship, and a door opens up and they go in. And we find all these stolen items in the time pod. And he's like, there's a visor in there, which means there's obviously more than one floating around because Geordi was wearing one. There's a visor in there and a couple tricorders and that neural scanner and a whole bunch of stuff. Also looks like some sort of Klingon blade, which I'm like, that doesn't seem like technology. That's not technology. It's the simplest just a really weapon cool and tool. Yeah. It's just a cool. He's like, oh, I'm just going to keep this for my wall mount memento, or whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Data's like, why have you stolen these things? Like to put in a museum or like what? And Rasmussen ends up pointing a phaser at Data. And now the story comes out. He's actually from the 22nd century. And he was a dismally unsuccessful inventor. And he conned a man who was really from the 26th century into like, he stole the time pod from him, or he conned it out of him some way.
Or he killed him, or who knows what.
Or something.
Someone from the 26th century landed in his backyard and he said,
in New Jersey.
Unfortunately for him, because
he met me.
Yeah, he met me. So he somehow took the time pod and got rid of this guy somehow, some nefarious way. And now he's like, mahaha. And it took him a long time to figure out how to use the ship, which is why I think that guy's probably dead. It took him a long time to figure out how to use the time pod, but he finally figured it out. And he's now come to the 24th century to steal a whole bunch of gadgets to take back to the 22nd century. And he's going to release a new quote unquote invention every single year until he dies and becomes super rich.
Yeah, he's going to be super rich and like he's going to invent a tricorder. Then he's going to invent a, you know, and he's probably going to come up with this whole like patented super secret. I can't divulge how I made this.
He's a con man. Of course he will.
Yeah, he's a con man. He's going to come up with something. But he was like, I was just going to release like one of these, you know, 8 bits of technology a year, you know, for a couple of years and just make a killing off of this. But he's like, but with you here, because as soon as like they went into the pod, the door shut. So the rest of the crew can't hear what's going on, but he's like, but with you in here, you are going to be like my ultimate coup d'etat. And I feel like maybe this guy should have taken a page off of like Kivas Fajo and try to make him like the most interesting toy or whatever. But he's basically going to take Data with him back to the 22nd century and like use him to, you know, he's going to make like hundreds of billions of dollars instead of millions, right? Mm-hmm. Because he's got this like prototype. Now he's like, unfortunately, you're not going to be awake for the ride. And he's like, this is set at the highest stun setting. So he's not going to kill Data or like destroy him, but he will stun him. And as he tries to fire, like nothing happens.
And he's like, such click, a great click, moment. I love click, that click, Data just click. Let him monologue, just let him do his evil monologue while Data's mm-hmm. just like, what else? Oh yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, click, ooh, click, scary. Click. Why isn't this working? Data just looks at him and goes, so I presume the door will open with your handprint, whether you're conscious or not. I will so knock you out and drag you to the door and use your hand to open the door. And he's like,
I just Vulcan neck pinched the shit out of CeeLo last week. I still know how to do it. Okay.
Yeah. And I love that he's like, the next scene you see him walking off the ship conscious.
Yeah. Like all like
plan B.
Yeah. Like just sad music. And he's like, I don't understand. This phaser was working like yesterday. What the heck? And Data fills everyone in on Rasmussen's con and they take him into custody. And they're like, well, you know, Worf was really brave. He went onto the ship, which was supposed to leave like in 2 minutes, mm-hmm. a minute and 45 seconds ago. So he's like, you better get on this thing and get the, you know, take all the technology out. So he brings this tray back that's got all the stuff that he had stolen. And everybody's like, really? A con artist from the 22nd century? Oh my gosh. And he's like, I got to get back. And I got to tell you, the actor did such a brilliant job at getting that like rising mm-hmm. panic feeling mm-hmm. because I felt that for him where it's like, oh man, he's really got to get back in that ship right now or he's stranded 300 years in the future where you don't know anyone and you're just out mm-hmm. of, you're out of luck. You're on your own. And the ship goes whoop and powers up and disappears. And he's like, no, right. As the ship is disappearing. And I felt that so deeply for the professor. I was like,
ooh, that's gotta hurt.
You're really stuck now. And as he's being led away, Picard says, oh, and professor, welcome to the 24th century and lead him away. And I was like, oh, it's so good. It's so good.
So there are a few things that happened. One, when the door opened, the ship detected all of the gadgets inside and deactivated all of them, including the phaser, which is why it suddenly didn't work. But they just couldn't penetrate the ship with the doors closed because it's all shielded and made of some weird metal or whatever. So they needed him to open the door. The second it was open, they already knew all the stuff was inside as soon as the door was open. But they did want to get the backstory. So it's nice that Data could get that out of him. The ship goes back to the 22nd century, presumably back to the guy's backyard and where it stays forever, ? We don't really know. The mm-hmm. third thing is Picard says, there are a lot of historians who are legitimate who would love to speak to somebody from your time period. And mm-hmm. it's just like such a good ironic ending because this
like,
whole
just
time,
a little juicy twist.
Yeah. Cause this whole time he's been like, I'm a historian and I need to know this about your time and that about your time. And now he's going to get that same treatment, you know, from behind bars, I guess, of like, what exactly did you wear? What are your shoes made out of? Ooh, what kind of soul is that? Like all this irritating stuff.
Oh my God.
Can
you imagine this professor just being like, oh God, please no more questions about footwear or food dispensers or like, oh, mm-hmm. he's just going to have the biggest tantrum. Now, the way that Picard says, welcome to the 24th century to me was so reminiscent of in yesterday's Enterprise when Captain Garrett woke up and she's like 85 years, like in the future now mm-hmm. with the Enterprise scene, he goes, welcome to the 24th century. It's the second time that Picard has had to welcome someone into his century, which is pretty crazy, but I enjoy this episode a lot. What are your final thoughts on this?
I thought he was such a smooth con man. I thought this professor so had good. Literally the perfect con. It was just completely airtight. And like Picard said, if he had just stolen fewer things, not as many things, they wouldn't have even noticed, and he would have totally gotten away with it to strike again and again and again and again.
Yep.
What about you?
Yep. That's absolutely, I think you're absolutely right. Like, he was a great con man, except he overplayed his hand. Mm-hmm. And if he would have been just a little bit more cautious, he would have just gotten away with it. And they would have been like, okay, well, thanks for visiting, Professor. Bye. And that would have been that. This episode is a fun watch. I always enjoy it. I look forward to it a lot. This was an episode that I mentioned in our season 4 wrap episode where I was like, ooh, I'm really excited about this one. It's just fun, especially after the heaviness of last few weeks episodes with all this Vulcan Romulan crap and all this like shady underground dealings and like double crossings and triple crossings. This just felt like a light juice cleanse. Like, it was just refreshing. And like, I just feel kind of cleaned up after all that Vulcan Romulan crap that I'm so over. No, it just felt like popcorn. It was like light and fun and frothy and like just fun, just fun. And I really, really am happy to have gotten to watch this episode. Thank you so, so much for listening. Next week, we are breaking down season 5, episode 10, New Ground. We will see you all next week.
Bye.
Thanks for geeking out with us. Be sure to join the crew at thetngpodcast.com to be the first to know when we do our live shows or host events exclusively for our members. We'll see you next time.